whenever candlelights flicker, where the air is deathly still, that is the time when ghosts are present, practicing their terror with ghoulish delight.
Welcome, everyone, to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me, as always, is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hello, Matt. Hello, everyone. We ain't afraid of no reboot, or are we?
Well, Pete, I suppose time will tell on that. Today, of course, we are talking Ghostbusters 2016, the new film, the much buzzed about film, the much discussed film, now out there in the wild, now viewable, viewed by us opening night, and I can't wait to get into digesting this movie.
Let's do it.
Well, Pete, I'll start with my opening thoughts, my unequivocal volley of happiness. This was a delightful movie to see. None of the gloom and doom naysayer worries to me were met. This was a rollicking good time at the summer movie theater. I left there with some thrills, some chills, some affirmation, and some laughs.
Well, unfortunately, I have to take the other side. I went in so prepared to enjoy this, and it was a disappointment. I can't say a super disappointment because I think there's been a lot of troubling stops along the way. But for me, what you're left with is a really disappointing mixed bag.
Pete, I'm interested to hear more as to why you think that is. To me, they had so many masters to serve in this movie. There's the nostalgia aspect of it that is increasingly a part of the movies that we see. All these reboots and tangential reboots and all of this fitting under nostalgia. There was that. There was the need for effects. There was the need to get to know the new characters. There was the need for comedy. And I felt beyond pleasantly surprised. Certainly the worst case scenario, you know, we've all heard those reviews, read those reviews. Pete, I even caught some slack on Twitter for posting negative reviews. I was just going through the sites that first I and then you go through. So let's get into the discussion here about this movie that I really, really, really liked.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that so many of my problems with the movie stem not from what a lot of people thought would be the issue, in that we have a female reboot of, I mean, we've talked before, Matt. I don't worship at the altar of the original Ghostbusters. I saw it when it came out in 1984. I was 8 years old, on our like fifth or sixth try at the cinema back in the day when movies routinely sold out and you didn't burn a trip to the movie theater, you saw something else. So after four or five viewings of The Neverending Story, which seemed to never end, we finally got into Ghostbusters, you know, after all the buzz and everything. And okay, I remember it being driven, our desire to watch it being driven more by MTV and the music video than anything else. And okay, it was what it was. Let's put it that way. And then the sequel, of course, in 89, and bringing everything back 5 years later, and that, okay. I remember a little bit more excitement, obviously, because we knew what we were getting back into with the sequel. I own both movies on DVD. End of story. Okay. I think this film was so horribly written. And yeah, I think your point of how they had to service so many movie masters is important, but at the same time, some of these choices are just ridiculous. You know, I don't want to get bogged down with the precursor to this, but I got worried when that first trailer, after paying homage to what happened 30 years ago, the scientists and a friend and everything they happened, and then the confusion that followed after, not as if I or you were confused, but general cinema viewers were confused. Is this in the same universe? Is it different? Et cetera, et cetera. And then, Matt, we open with a barf joke. And the moment we get Melissa McCarthy introduced in this film with a food slash weight joke, I just think it was downhill from there.
Well, I'll say for my part, I do worship at the altar of the original one, and was too young to have seen it in theaters. At some point, you know, got it on tape, and probably concurrent with when the cartoon was out. I suspect that's what drove seeing the movie, although I don't remember it that way. And then spending those 5 years with the movie on tape. I know there was a stretch where my brother watched it every day for several months. I know that my dad has a story, and I remember things a little bit differently, but I trust his memory on this, where we woke up, my brother and I, who shared a room for a time, we woke up and we saw what my dad described as a pile of leaves on the lawn. And woke him up. Dad, there's a terror dog on the lawn. I also remember going to see the sequel as a 9-year-old and kind of coming back and being like, okay, that was more Ghostbusters. That was fun. So I think to look at the canon such as it is, you have a lightning in the bottle classic in the original. You have a middling sequel that beat for beat tries to replicate the first movie, and then to bring it to the writing of this one, where I think I'll take a couple points off, and it fits into the larger discussion of how you deal with these nostalgia genre movies, is they definitely hit many of the beats beat for beat in this movie that they do from the first one, which also happens to be the second one, because the second one is a poorly written copy of the first. I don't know whether, I mean, I think at the end of the day, I'm okay with it kind of cribbing the general shape and, oh, gee whiz, there's a giant thing in the third act that they have to battle. Okay, I guess that's what you do in Ghostbuster movies. I'm okay with that. But I agree it is an imperfect script. And I was careful as I was noting the highlights of the movie. I was careful the previous times I've done it on today's podcast to mention the comedy last, because I got a lot of good laughs last night. There were times where I was the only person laughing at the joke just because it was an in-joke or it struck me as a funny or whatever. Not as funny as the original, but I think it's more successful in other areas. Particularly, I think the story in general for me works.
And as you witnessed, I barely laughed. And I think, again, we come back to the writing. We're talking about a visual effects comedy, and at its worst, this is a very base piece of writing. I'm not going to deny there were a couple jokes that were funny, you know, the fart from the front, and who delivered that? Holtzman, okay, the breakout character of this movie. But, you know, I think it's a problem. Let's address the female issue. I am completely for female Ghostbusters. I was completely on board when that was announced, when there were people who were ready to burn Paul Feig in effigy in streets. I guess what I have a problem with is the repetition in terms of, well, there have to be four of them, and three must be scientists, and one must be the gadget person, and one's a professor, and one must be African American. And then where we go with that, we've got to give the funniest lines in the movie to the cheesecake receptionist. That worries me. This is supposed to be a female vehicle. we couldn't figure out some way to can we only write funny female or funny male receptionist dialogue? Is that it? Like, McCarthy had very few yucks, and if any, I cannot. I've gone back over the movie trying to figure out what was something funny that she did or said. Maybe the proton pack alley sequence of her like a balloon, but I think that was more driven by the description of it, less by her physical comedy.
I certainly agree that the funniest character in Ghostbusters is not a Ghostbuster. It is the Chris Hemsworth character.
Is that not a problem? Janine wasn't the funniest character. And again, you know, I keep coming back to, I don't want to compare it to the original, but I think I'm forced to compare it to the original.
Well, and I think that there's so much in this movie that I think is larger than this movie. This is a movie that exists, for better or worse, beyond the four sides of the screen. I would argue that actually ups its stakes to a certain degree, in that what do we look for in not just popular culture, but in certainly literature, in art in general? We look for ourselves. And while, I mean, Pete, you and I, of course, can both, we look at Chris Hemsworth and we see a physical resemblance. But I mean, well, that's not a joke, but I mean, jokes aside, I'm certainly not saying you and I need to find, darn it, Pete, there needs to be more white guys. We need to find people like that. But we can see society, and we can see social change and social concern in this movie. To bring it to this issue of nostalgia, clearly the decision was made in the scripting process to play this along the template of the original. You mentioned after we left the theater last night, you said, well, you know, in Star Trek, they don't do this. Yeah, but the Star Trek audience is used to different combinations. There's the different shows. There's the two different movie cycles. Heck, within the classic Trek movies, they rebooted from the motion picture to Star Trek II. So I think for better or worse, and perhaps it's for worse, although the product is a very, very good movie, for better or worse, they decided to make this along that familiar template.
Did you just call this a very, very good movie?
Yes, I would not call it I would not call it a great. I would not call it a great movie. I had a very, very good time. I was entertained. There were thrills. There were chills. There was social commentary, and there were laughs. And the laughs are last in that list because it was not. I was going to say it's not as funny as the first, but here's the thing.
Is that not a problem with a female-led comedy, that the laughs came last?
The answer for me is I don't know, and here's why.
I don't know if you can call it a very, very good movie if you don't know. I think you're driven. You've fallen into the nostalgia portal, Matt.
Well, let me tell you why I can't know, and it's something that has colored this movie from its inception, is what people bring to it ahead of time. I'll call it baggage, although I don't think that because you have particular views this way or that, it's not necessarily baggage. It's your own perception. Growing up as a kid, Ghostbusters was not a funny movie. A lot of the humor, maybe minus Lewis Tully, a lot of the humor in the original, I think, goes over the head of a 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old. It's Mila time is a line I needed my mom to explain, because I didn't understand what Mila was. And then she told me Miller and beer, and he's talking about, oh, it's party time. Okay. The contrast of there's a monster coming. Oh, it's being treated like Godzilla. What is it? This is the big bad. It's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. The fact that there's humor there, you know, I didn't get as a kid. So it was not a funny movie. It was a fun movie with thrills and chills and so on and so forth, and also some laughs because Lewis is a funny guy. So much of it is deadpan. So that's why I say I don't know if it's a problem, because I never experienced the first one as the comedy I do now. And the part of the reason I experience the original as a comedy now is because I know the jokes, because it's all burned into my brain. Back off, man, I'm a scientist, is funny because it is. It's not, I have a bunch of pies and then a bunch of stairs. Whoop, whoop, whoop. Funny. So that's why I say it's not, I don't know if it's a problem. I know I didn't laugh as much as I did have in other movies, say Deadpool, from this year. But I also know I had a great time at the movie theater.
Well, let's deviate from the comedy route then. Let's talk thrills and chills, as you refer to them. Okay. How about the bad guy plot with frames straight out of the Haunted Mansion at Disney, Matt? what exactly was that about? And as I asked you during the film, where did he get them? And where's can I have some story, please?
I agree that the movie is a bit weak in the bad guy venue of things. In fact, I'm reminded of Ivan Reitman just this past weekend. Hollywood Reporter, you know, had him do a lengthy oral history of his involvement in Ghostbusters, and it was Sigourney Weaver's idea for her to become a possessed, you know, devil dog, terror dog. And that's when he walked away. They were still in the process of putting the script together, and that's when he said, oh, now that makes this conflict more personable, and it kind of brings things into focus. This was an unfocused bad guy. There weren't ghosts, so now he's bringing ghosts, and it's with a machine that's like their machine. Oh, it is their machine. They're kind of to blame.
And now, I kind of dug that circular nature there. I didn't find the bad guy a problem. I found that he has weird frames around this, but machine that he's made, like that took me out of it.
I will admit that there was not a scene like when the Ghostbusters in the original, when they're in the prison and they sit and go, here's the history of the building and it's metal and it's going to be a portal. There wasn't a scene that kind of spelled it out. I think it was kind of covered in when he's first introduced as the bad guy and he's talking to himself in the mirror, that it's the thin connection points between the two realms.
The ley lines. Yes,
not just the ley lines, but I think like I kind of read the frames as that's the thinnest part of the ley line and so forth. Again, it's not a full defense. It's not, Pete, you misunderstood. When Khan said, I'm going to kill you, Kirk, for the death of my family, that was, you missed the clear statement of bad guy-edness. It was a weaker area of the story.
I even liked the ley line situation, and it made sense to me what they were doing. Enough of their own thing, but a backup to the original. But now, Matt, I'll ask you again. Can you tell me what exactly happened in Times Square in this movie?
Well, after weakening the ley lines to their focal point at the central hub in Times Square, he released a bunch of ghosts and then made Times Square appear as a mishmash of the past for reasons I'm not clear on, other than I know for one thing they didn't shoot for weeks and weeks in Times Square. So if that's to hide the transition to a set or a blue screen version of Times Square, okay, you know, fine. If that's behind the scenes inside baseball stuff, I don't know why. These ghosts are from the past, therefore Times Square shall look like the past, with references to 1930s movies and Taxi Driver and all in between.
There's a Godfather marquee visible at one point. There's a Boris Karloff movie poster, big sign over a building. There's a Woolworths. He made one line, Matt. There's one line of reference that it'll be like it used to be. That's it. Okay. And I knew going in there, they were going to change Times Square. And I'm like, okay, that's an interesting concept. Let's see how this is handled. And it all falls apart on the page and makes what you're presented with just that much more of, you know, you're trying to hold things together with paper, with a wet paper towel, Matt. You know, okay, so that we have the ley lines and we're going to have this convergence at Times Square makes sense, but the execution's just dumb and the editing reinforces this, that we have to reinsert a undoubtedly cut disco sequence where Rowan is going to command the living in addition to the dead that he wanted to do, because that master plan of prophecy of, all right, I'm going to not only get caught, I'm going to electrocute myself, I'm going to become a ghost, and then I'm going to command the dead. And then he disco poses all of the cops, which is never explained. They never move. And then we're treated to the outtake during maybe the most confusing and just attention pulling credit sequence I've ever seen.
Okay. First of all, you make a movie three times: when you write it, when you shoot it, and when you edit it. I don't know what the movie looked. I don't know what the script looked like with a dance sequence where Rowan, then played by Hemsworth, starts to dance and so on and so forth. I don't know what that looked like in the script. I don't know what that looked like when they filmed it. I don't know what the director's cut looked like, et cetera, et cetera. All I can assume is that they gave us the best version of the movie from the footage that they shot, from the footage, from the words and scenes that were scripted. I didn't feel like there was a scene missing there. If there was more to it and you spent a day with Hemsworth dancing and you have that footage left over and you want to give people the soft exit that the original had and that a number of movies now do, with interesting things to look at while at least part of the credits roll. In this case, it was most of it. If it wasn't Hemsworth dancing, it was just, you know, bits and bobs from the movie, then moving the credits around. Like, I'm all for that. These people work hard for the movies. You want to give us shiny lights to look at, so we look at who the best boy was and the gaffer and craft services. Fine. So they cut a scene of him dancing and then used it for part of the credits. I'm okay with that.
Wasn't just him dancing. It was all the extras dancing. It was those other actors dancing. Matt, they got this thing in the editing bay, and there's a cut somewhere that exists with that happening, and somebody came in. If it wasn't Feig, it was somebody at Sony, and they said, oh, no, 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 no. This is not working. Yet they moved it to another part of the film, and given what goes on during those credits, I think we really need to consider that part of the film, because there are things – you know, the Sigourney Weaver cameo, the Zool thing at the end. It's part and parcel, and it's a mess, Matt. It's a mess.
I mean, just because they took footage from a deleted scene and used a guy dancing ostensibly to music to be played while, or many characters dancing ostensibly to music while music is actually playing for the audience. I mean, it was clear that that wasn't meant to be part of the story, versus, say, the Sigourney Weaver cameo, the things where the credits actually stop and there's an actual moment.
But your brain reassembles it as such because you can recognize that that's what it's from. It would be different if – and I could even get behind, all right, maybe we just have Hemsworth. But no, it's the reactionary shots of him doing gun hands – and then cops doing gun hands because he's controlling them. It's really bad, Matt. But let me get to the worst of it. Okay, we get the choose the form of your destruction. Not sure where we've heard that before. And the horrible animation, the cartoon that pops up. The Ghostbusters logo, I like how they had cribbed it from a Banksy, if you will, a wannabe Banksy. It was a clever insertion there in the subway, but it comes across here in cartoon format and then turns into the big thing trope at the end of, as you referenced, apparently what we do at the end of a Ghostbusters movie is there's a big thing. Not quite sure where the bow tie came from. And, you know, this is after we've already had the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man balloon homage, which was kind of cute. Maybe, Matt, if they get their sequel, because we've already thrown Zool's name out there, and even non-spoiler Matt knew to listen for that, maybe Zool can have them choose the form of their destruction again in their non-existent sequel.
I agree that the switch to animation was weird. I think
jarring.
I would agree. I would agree. Perhaps jarring. I think that on the page or in the pitch, it was like they have this animated logo or this, you know, this hand drawn logo, whatever you want to call it. I mean, I know it's not animated motion, but they have this logo, the Ghostbuster No Ghost logo, and Rowan is now going, oh, that's your logo. Let me show it in cartoon. Let me show it moving.
I get that progression. Cool World, have I seen a more jarring?
It sounds better, and certainly once they get to the real version, real computer generated, whatever. I kind of dug it that it was like the ghost from Ghostbusters. You know, the ghost from the No Ghost is now coming after them. I dug the destination, the journey there. Definitely a little jarring.
I just think, Matt, this project, no pun intended, has gestated too long. There were rumors of a third movie in the 90s. The pitch that got the furthest along was the baton pass to a cast of Ben Stiller and Chris Farley when he was still with us. And an interesting setup in that the original Ghostbusters would have been sucked into hell, which would have mirrored the island of Manhattan. And the new guys would have to get them back to the other side. And there you go. Is it bold? I don't think so. Would it have made money? I think undoubtedly. There were all these different things. We know that Murray was constantly a source of frustration and hesitation. I still think it should have been a baton pass. You could have handed this off to the female cast instead of the confusion early on in the marketing of 30 years ago. Nope. No, 30 years ago you watched a movie, but this doesn't pay attention to that movie, but it does. Very confusing. And we get these repeated beats. Here's my biggest concern. I worry that my nieces are going to see this only to discover another movie later that they will ultimately realize is superior. So the Ghostbusters movie for them is not the Ghostbusters movie everybody loves. And I don't want to sound harsh when I say that, because I'm looking forward to the Ocean's 11 female reboot. I think that can be really cool. I still hope that they get a sequel out of this, and I hope they get to make it their own and take things further. But I just feel like this was such a convoluted mess. The actors, I think for the most part, did their level best. This thing was poorly written and poorly crafted.
Ouch. Well, Pete, let's talk about something that I know we both agree on, and a bright spot that we both agree on. For me, the brightest spot in this very, very good movie, and that is Kate McKinnon's character of Holtzman.
Yeah, that they made the decision to count the Ghostbusters cartoon presentation of Egon and to tap that as the influence for her character, I think was brilliant. Whoever made that decision at least got something right. Did a really good job. She was excellent. This is a star-making role for her. And between this and the springboard she'll have in the fall on Saturday Night Live when she plays Hillary Clinton, we're looking at the Tina Fey moment here for Kate McKinnon. Touching moment. We talked about this afterward last night with her toast in the restaurant afterward. You know, I know there's the is she gay, is she not gay thing. It doesn't matter. I don't see why that's even part of the discussion. She was a wonderful character. I want more of her. I think the danger they're going to go into if they get a second movie, and we're going to talk about the reasons, my reasons, we'll talk about money, why I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's going to be the temptation, well, let's make it the Holtzman show.
I would be totally in favor of that. I just thought that she was a delight. I loved how the character of Holtzman was slightly out of sync with the other ladies, and that worked particularly well before Patty joined the team, because you kind of had this former friendship, former bond between the Whig character and the McCarthy character. And then I just dug everything about her as a character. I think that she's going to inspire young women and girls to be more science oriented. You can be kind of wacky and weird and into science and into gadgets and that sort of thing, and still be yourself.
And that's one of many great things about the character, that some little girl is going to get into a STEM career and at some point write an essay about, you know, Jillian Holtzman. That's exciting.
But by the way, Pete, Kate McKinnon, do you know what her alma mater is?
MIT?
Nope. Columbia. So you have that in common with
her. There you go. Yeah, I mean, she was great. But, you know, is Egon the breakout character of the original?
Well, Egon was my favorite character in the original.
Really?
So I think in part because the comedy of the other two scientists is less obvious when you're a kid, whereas Egon saying "I collect spores, molds, and fungus," that's kind of more obviously funny than when Dana comes to visit the office and in the background, Bill Murray shoots up and comes running over because he's a horn dog. Well, as a kid, you're like, he wants to like her or something. He wants to take her case. He wants to get dinner with her because I guess you have dinner when you meet with clients. I don't really understand. She gets, in my mind, the climax of the movie, where it's the theme full on fight in Times Square, lengthy, unbroken fight against CGI ghosts and so on and so forth.
Cheesy computer graphics with smoke machine smoke.
I'll say this about the effects. I think that the analog optical effects in the original, to me, looked better, even when it's clearly a puppet that is half faded in. I felt like there was a tangible nature to the ghosts in the original because of the limitations of technology, whereas now you can make them whatever you want. And I felt that the effects overall were not as good. And while we're talking about effects, if I have one major this is my biggest complaint about the movie, Pete. I'm about to lay it on you and lay it on the audience. They should have used the original Ecto-1 siren sound. This is America. We don't have growling cat.
That they referenced that in the script. A decidedly un-American siren on your unlicensed nuclear vehicle. I can actually get behind. I think there's plenty of other complaints to be made, Matt. But the A story, the Aaron and Abby story, which initially pulls them together, does not hold together in the middle of the story. And then, all right, she goes through the portal and rescues her friend, and they come out with white hair because they saw ghosts, which they saw the whole movie, but nobody else's hair has turned white. Okay, so they didn't go through the portal. Matt, that we're talking about the B story, again, is further evidence that this thing is a train wreck as a piece of storytelling. I'm really surprised that Leslie Jones' Patty wasn't funnier either. You could write a whole lot more for her to do. They used all the funny stuff that she did in trailers. And I think it's the Will Ferrell effect. They test this stuff. They put it out there. And all right, you've seen all the funny things she says in the movie. And McCarthy, I got to say, you know, and this has nothing to do with her venom that she spouted and that they used the internet refrain in the script. They went back and added that women couldn't be Ghostbusters. But I got to say, I thought she was completely meh.
I think she probably was the least funny of the four. Again, I'm a little less concerned about the lack of comedy. Pardon me. She was the least funny of the five. Now, I know on Twitter I had mentioned that the marketing of this movie, and you've mentioned the marketing a couple times, Pete, and I want to, before I continue, the first thing, say, let's just differentiate here between the film and its voice and its set of authors, which can include studio suits and all of that. That is separate from the marketing message, which, yes, is also at the end of the day, you know, a product of studio suits. But this whole issue of 30 years ago, four scientists. Oh, no, they're not. Winston wasn't a scientist. 30 years ago, four friends. Well, I guess they were kind of friends, except, you know, like, that's from the marketing department. That's not, you know, Melissa McCarthy and Paul Feig sit down and go, all right, four scientists, because we don't know our original movie. But I digress.
Why couldn't there be five female Ghostbusters? Why couldn't they all be scientists? Why couldn't only one of them be scientists? Why do we need such a beat for beat tether to the past, yet we want to have it be fresh and new and different?
Oh, that I totally agree with. I continue to have concerns that many smart people who were in the process of saying, let's reevaluate the traditional, you know, male white scope of things, let's reboot Ghostbusters and still have a character of color where there's just one character of color as a Ghostbuster, and she's gonna still be the street smart every person. I would argue that Patty represents the every person less than Winston did, but not being this specialized scientist, being a more common person than the other three scientists. I still kind of call that into question. Could we have a black Ghostbuster be a scientist? We have a black Ghostbuster be ostensibly the lead as Aaron is? So I am troubled by that, let's say, in the scripting phase. As soon as you get Leslie Jones on board, I don't watch Saturday Night Live regularly, in part because I don't
no
like to
see...
No
one does, Matt. Yeah. No one does.
I like it when Dig tells me on a Sunday morning what the 2.5 funny minutes were, and I've enjoyed her in that regard. I enjoyed her presence, and not knowing her oeuvre of work very well, I don't know... I don't put it this way. I get the impression that Leslie Jones as Patty Tolan was similar. You know, that's kind of where she's comfortable as an actress and whatnot. Okay, that's fine. I have no problem with Leslie Jones once she walks through the door. I just, why did Patty have to be an MTA worker who knows that the subways smell of urine, whereas Gillian Holtzman can make these fantastic things while everybody else is just having downtime. Like, why is the least intelligent of the four official Ghostbusters, asterisk for Chris Hemsworth, Beckman, why is she the least educated and also the one of color? That's a bit concerning.
Well, I think, again, going on evidence, she talked about how she reads a lot of nonfiction, and do we want to carry the street smart further that, you know, though she may only be a lowly MTA, you know, booth worker, that, you know, she's kind of like a historian of the underground and possibly more so of the occult. I like that they give her the tease-worthy moment at the end that she hears the Zool. And let's hope, Matt, if they get that sequel, that she could grow more. But I was let down. I really wanted more from her. That Hemsworth's himbo is so front and center in the advertising, okay, that they move the bad guy into his body. That he's, you know, we can't even compare it. He's the biggest box office draw as an actor in this movie because of his previous body of work. Does that force him here?
I guarantee you that someone at the studio, someone at Sony said, now that we have Chris Hemsworth, and now that we're at whatever early stage, we just have a script or we're starting to shoot or whatever, we need to up this to get men in the theater. Someone, I guarantee you, said that. I don't know whether that's true as an audience member. I think you and I were going to see a Ghostbusters
regardless
movie. Yeah.
We really were going regardless. And, you know, again, I don't want to have this be that I'm throwing stones, because, you know, you can ask Matt, and Matt, maybe you'll back me up here, that I was as prepared to have a good time as you, but I just think, yeah, it was not there.
Certainly Hemsworth in the advertising, same thing. Somebody from the marketing department at Sony said, get more of him out there. Men are frightened that there's not enough chiseled white men in the movie. And
it wasn't a concern I had going in. It really wasn't.
And I'm certainly not saying you, Pete. I'm not speaking for either of us. I guarantee you that once you had Chris Hemsworth signed, people whose jobs exist not to create but to sell upped his presence, perhaps in the movie, certainly in the marketing, so that with all of this buzz, there's no such thing as bad publicity. Oh yeah, ask Fantastic Four. Guess what? There is. And it was like, this is a way through where my lady will go for Melissa McCarthy, but I'll go for the Chris Hemsworth. I think that was the marketing decision. That certainly was not our decision. But Pete, let's move on. Let's talk here a little bit about fan service. What is fan service, Pete?
Well, I think with a franchise such as this, obviously there's things you need to touch on. But again, the way in which they did it was largely confusing, or you needed to know that you were looking for it. I knew about all the cameos except Potts going in, Rick Moranis turned this down. He hasn't made a movie in, I think it's 15 or 16 years. This was not the movie to come back for.
We should mention Rick Moranis unquestionably retired. Like he had initially taken a hiatus after his wife passed away in 1997, and simply has chosen. I believe that the quote is, with all the Honey, I Shrunk the money, I don't need to work anymore. So he has just simply chosen not to work. He lives in Midtown Manhattan. And, you know, so it's not that, oh, I won't dare do a Ghostbuster. It's just, no, I don't work.
Man, I gotta wonder when the Spaceballs awaken, if there's, you know, not some way we can't get Dark Helmet back for a scene, but we digress. But, you know, that you and I know we're looking at a bust of toward the end of his life, Harold Ramis, quickly in a Columbia University hallway, and people are going to need to find that out in a BuzzFeed listicle problem.
First of all, I disagree. I think that most fans will see that the camera lingers long enough on the bust to say, oh, that's Harold Ramis, who, if I care enough, I should know that he passed away. That said, I mean, you can't have the camera linger too long on an unmoving statue. Then it becomes either macabre or, oh, let's make the statue move because it has a ghost because he's dead. No, that's awful. I think that most fans of the original, the fans whose childhoods might have been ruined by this movie, in air quotes, if you're that much of a fan that you had concerns about what this would do in relation to the original, whether you found fault or like me, saw the sunny sunshine that's in the movie, I think you would have recognized Harold Ramis.
Did they need to use Columbia? And I can't believe that I'm saying that aloud. They talk about Princeton. I love the Charles Dance character's disdain of Princeton. We're united in that. But again, can you make it your own? Why not just have them? I love the grittiness of the school that's been open for not very long, that McCarthy's character and McKinnon's character are at. Why couldn't we explore that road instead of, nope, we gotta have academia. We must have scenes of people walking down cobblestone lined paths.
I'm okay with that. I mean, the original, in the original, they're in unnamed Columbia.
In both.
Yeah. And then, but you beat me to the punch, Pete. And then in the sequel, he's still back there. Yeah. Sorry. So the decision was made to make this movie. Well, let's use a Jurassic Park reference here, Pete. They took the DNA of the original, and they didn't add much frog DNA or lizard DNA. They were looking to make an original Stegosaurus with a couple of changes here and there.
Let's continue down that path, Matt. Let's have the firehouse, then have them choose a Chinese restaurant as a headquarters, and then go back to the firehouse at the end of the movie.
And you know what? I'm okay with that. In the beginning, it's a cute little yuck moment, and then you go, okay, first of all, the firehouse, insofar as in the original, New York City is a character, it's a different New York City then versus now. The New York City of the early 1980s was not that far away from the Bronx is burning, and bills aren't being paid, and crime is through the roof, and certainly there's in New York City now, the murder rate, I mean, a 20th of what it was a generation ago, certainly not wading into some of the police excess issues, but things like gentrification and rents going up, there's no notion that the Ghostbusters of today would end up in a neighborhood like a demilitarized zone. So I love that they go there and you have the exterior space, which is still there. It's a working firehouse. They go in there, they've replicated the interior set. They play around in it for a second, find out what the rent is, and then end up in an awful place. This is a movie that consistently, for whatever reason, perhaps good, perhaps bad, lowers the scale in which these characters work. It's a smaller home base. It's a car with less doodads on it. The proton packs are not as powerful. They don't shoot as far. You know, little things like that. I think they give them a little bit more of a mountain to climb. Is that maybe because they've been planning a sequel all along? Okay. I mean, that's what you do nowadays. You make the first in a sequel, and you hope it's gonna work. But I'm okay with at the end. I don't know how much nerd time one wants to spend on, oh, it's alternate realities and there's destiny and discussions of that. But Pete, Ghostbusters are supposed to end up in the firehouse. And I like that at the end of it, in a gentrified New York with much more expensive rent rates for downtown, I like that they end up in the firehouse with the help of the city of New York.
I was okay with their new place. I thought it was fine. I thought it was their own. Apparently, I'm in the minority. Bill Murray's cameo, Matt, because of course he gets more scenes than anyone else. His two scene cameo and what you called his likely contractually obligated death.
To me, Pete, it's fitting that of everybody, if somebody's going to get a two-scene cameo, it's going to be Bill Murray. At any rate, the idea that the person who is probably most people's favorite Ghostbuster gets offed by a ghost, I think, if nothing else, he was like, you're gonna pay me handsomely to cameo in this movie, and because I'm going to go to my grave being best remembered for Ghostbusters and not Lost in Translation or a zillion other small movies that he's done, I at least want to have that death on screen if that's what I'm going to be remembered for in real life.
Poor Annie Potts, Matt. You come out of that cameo and she's a hotel desk attendant.
How about this? She's still answering the phone. She still has "What do you want?" And also, Pete, I would say this: she was 33 in the first movie. She's 63 now. If she looks a little older, that's because 30 years have gone on. And I thought she still looks lovely and had certainly that wonderful Janine vibe to her, Pete.
The giant ghost Stay Puft Statue of Liberty trope for me would work better if we didn't have to throw the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man balloon in this, I guess.
Pete, the cameos required for this movie weren't just the original four Ghostbusters and Sigourney Weaver and Annie Potts. You also needed two other important cameos. You needed Mr. Stay Puft and you needed Slimer, and they delivered on both. I think that was a perfect example, particularly with Mr. Stay Puft, of having your cake and eating it too. You have to have him there, but he can't be the big giant bad guy. So if anything, if the whole balloon attack, if that's somewhat backward engineered from, we have to have a big Mr. Stay Puft, but he can't be as physical as what's going to be our big giant bad guy at the end, which is inspired by the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, then we're going to have it be Thanksgiving balloons taken over and so on and so forth. I'm fine with all that. It was great to see Mr. Stay Puft back on the big screen again.
Did we need Slimette?
Well, first of all, I prefer to call her Ms. Slimer.
He put a ring on it? If they're non-corporeal, how is that even possible?
Pete, she doesn't need a ring to make the decisions that she wants to in life with her ghost body or her ghost career or whatever. Let me put it this way. At first, it was like, oh, now there's Mr. Potato Head and Mrs. Potato Head. But Pete, I go back to the genesis of Slimer. Do you know the genesis of Slimer?
Enlighten me.
The genesis of Slimer was this. When Ghostbusters was in its first unfilmable story form, in which it took place in the future and there were competing groups of Ghostbusters, and it would have cost $800 million in 1982 to make, it was written by Dan Aykroyd to be a Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi partnership, a la Blues Brothers. John Belushi died in part because of those excesses, drug overdose. So you have Slimer in the original, which was meant to be kind of the spiritual, no pun intended, representation of John Belushi enjoying the excesses of food and drink. What do we add to it in this, in a slight winking way? Food and drink and, you know, the bedroom. So the fact that Slimer, the ghost of John Belushi, likes to eat and drink and be with Ms. Slimer, that's how I explain it to myself.
That thing, that will become an internet meme, Matt. The horrible, the horrible wig. You want to bring back Slimer, bring back Slimer. And I agree with you on every note we've hit on the list of the cameos, but that you add that, that it's almost so in your face of, well, we have to have a female one because this is the female version of the Ghostbusters and female Slimer.
I hadn't even thought of it like that. That's interesting. I'll tell you this, props for introducing Slimer coming out of the hot dog cart as he did.
Well, that's the only way you can, that's the only way you can do it.
Pete, what cameos have we yet to discuss?
Ernie Hudson, Matt, right before the credits, shows up as we had to expect the uncle of Patty Tolan there, the undertaker, the funeral director with his now lost Cadillac and lending a new one.
It was nice to see him. I am a little hesitant to get behind the following scenario. You get Bill Murray back and he plays like, you know, kind of an anti-Ghostbuster, if you will. It's totally different. He's a skeptic. You get Dan Aykroyd there, and he's, you know, he's got it. It's a short cameo, but he's got the "I'm the New York taxi driver. I ain't afraid of no ghosts." Yuck line. Tip of the hat. Okay, great. You get Annie Potts. Bringing the same sizzle that she did answering the phone. What do you want, etc. Okay, fine. We'll talk about Sigourney Weaver in a minute. And the Ernie Hudson cameo. He's in the whole rainbow of humanity. The Ernie Hudson cameo has him related to the other black character because it's a small world. That makes me cringe a little bit.
I can see that argument, but when you're name checking a character, and the realities of race, it was the logical spot for the cameo. So I was okay with that. What I was not okay with, Matt, is that we relegate Sigourney Weaver's cameo to the credits. To the credits!
I would argue, Pete, that though the credits were going on, the movie wasn't over. And I love it when movies do that.
I argued that before. I think it's part and parcel, but it's still the credits.
How about this, Pete? We got at the end of Age of Ultron, we got characters that were going to, we got a cameo from characters who were going to appear in the next movie. Has she not been relegated, perhaps, has she not been relegated to the credits, but rather might appear in Ghostbusters 2 with more of that character? Maybe not lots and lots, but... will we maybe get more of her? Is it maybe an elevation?
I thought they were going to make her Holtzman's mom or a relative. I like, and again, they took nearly no missteps with McKinnon's character, you know, a strong role model professor type with her there. It fits.
Yeah. I agree it fits. And again, I don't worry that it was in the credits because this is a movie that the party is continuing through most of the credits. The movie is continuing. And then Pete, that brings us to something we've discussed a little bit already. This movie might have no Dana, but there is only Zool at the end.
Is there a sequel or is there only Zool? We get that much ballyhooed name check there. Patty delivers the line. Well, Matt, what was, without going to look for it, unless you know the number, do you know what the budget on this movie was?
I believe after tax incentives and credits, it cost the studio $140 million to make.
$144 to be precise, and more than $100 million spent to this point on ad buys.
I don't know how the Hollywood accountant, I don't know where promotion goes in terms of keeping a movie successful. So I guess I'm neither agreeing nor disagreeing with that as a number that the movie needs to quote unquote make up. I think the best scenario is when you make back your production budget and your advertising budget and quite a bit more. The fact that right now, as we record, it's slated for a $45 million opening weekend is not great for a sequel. I believe the comment that I read on Deadline was from a Columbia person or a Sony Pictures person that said, essentially, now we need the international market to make up the difference. There's probably going to be a sequel to Warcraft, which bombed in this country and made like hand over fist money in China, for example. So Ghostbuster fans of the world, go see this movie so we can get more Ghostbusters.
I can't give that. I don't know if I can necessarily do that to people.
Well, I certainly welcome more. Pete, I'll tell you this. I'll go even one further. I may see this movie in the theaters again in the next couple of weeks. That's how much I enjoyed it.
God bless you.
Well, Pete, as we start to wrap up our discussion on Ghostbusters, what's next on the old Pop Culture Podcast?
Well, at least I will be moving on with Star Trek Beyond. We'll go back to the franchise well, but with a movie that has already got press reviews far exceeding the one we're talking about today.
Certainly, that should be a ton of fun. The early reviews for that are quite favorable. So I guess time will tell. I know that when last we went to the movies for Star Trek, the experience was... I've never had a movie grow in my appreciation in 24 hours from walking out of Star Trek Into Darkness saying, that was really good, and realizing in the ensuing 24 hours that it is perhaps the second best Star Trek movie in my estimation. So it'll be interesting to go back to the future of Star Trek.
We'll be seeing that Thursday night. We'll be bringing that to you, of course, next weekend, in addition to our already existing Star Trek Essential podcast, which drop on Tuesdays.
Absolutely. And Pete, of course, best of all, how can people be in touch with you on the Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R-J, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R, 8,002 followers. Can't be wrong.
And while I am personally on Twitter as Looking Back Lost, you can be in touch with the podcast in a whole host of ways. We are a fantastic geek that is fantastic with the P and the H. You can find us under that name on the .com, the Gmail, the Instagram, the Twitter. But wait, Pete, there's more. Is it... Pete, we know about Tobin's Spirit Guide. Are there any other books where you can find Fantastic Geek?
Yeah, Mr. Zuckerberg has created one, thefacebook.com/Fantastic Geek with the PH all one word. Get on it, like us, and tell us what you thought of Ghostbusters 2016.
Well, Pete, this has been certainly thrills and chills and laughs along the way as we've discussed Ghostbusters. So once again, I really enjoyed it. You can send your vile anger towards Pete and not me, and because I thought it was great, great fun. With that, Pete, I will say adios to all our listeners and give you the nervous, what will it be, final word.
I'm not afraid, not afraid. Restless bones, he's in your mind. Restless roots of heavy side is heat.
If you would like to join a jamboree, there's a simple rule that's compulsory. Mortals pay a token fee. Rest in peace, the haunting's free.
significant.